there is no ban in perpetuity on making covenants with non-Israelite nations. Only in the Holy Land must pagan places of worship be destroyed. Verse 13. No, you must tear down their altars, smash their pillars, and cut down their sacred posts. God commands the Israelites to destroy the Canaanites' places of worship, not to kill the Canaanites. The only divinely sanctioned violence here is against inanimate objects. With regard to Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 17, where Moses, not God, instructs the Israelites to kill the Canaanites, see the commentary there. As noted previously, neither the Israelites then nor the Jewish people later are ever commanded to destroy pagan places of worship outside Israel. But it would have been impossible to establish ethical monotheism in the Holy Land if pagan places of worship, with their human sacrifices and cult orgies, were allowed to remain. Verse 14. For you must not worship any other god, because the Lord, whose name is impassioned, is an impassioned God. If the Israelites worship other gods, they are nullifying the purpose of the Exodus and of their existence as a nation. Prostitutes are not the worst form of prostitution. Verse 15. You must not make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, for they will lust after their gods and sacrifice to their gods and invite you, and you will eat of their sacrifices. Regarding covenants with the Canaanite nations, see comments to chapter 34, verse 12. The word translated as "they will lust" literally means, "and they will prostitute themselves." Among the aberrant practices to ensue if the Israelites followed the Canaanite gods was the Israelite god and religion would become sexualized. Pagan worship often involved cult prostitution and sexual displays on the altar. The Torah, in contrast, insists God is not a sexual being, and sex has no place in religious worship. Metaphorically speaking, people prostitute themselves whenever they compromise their higher values, whether for money, success, fame, or anything else people crave. A prostitute sells her body for money. A crook sells his character for money. A crooked politician sells his influence for money. People sell their souls, prostitute themselves for a whole host of desired things. And one might say such individuals are considerably worse than a prostitute. She sells her body. They sell their souls. And crooks and others who prostitute their values do greater harm to society than prostitutes. Note, A, the positive way in which the Hebrew Bible depicts the prostitute Rahab, Joshua chapter 2. The Talmud went so far as to claim Rahab became a Jew, married Joshua, Moses' successor, and that generations later the prophet Jeremiah descended from her. B, the sympathetic depiction of Tamar, who, though not a prostitute, on one occasion acted as a prostitute for a noble end, Genesis chapter 38. C, the Torah never depicts a prostitute as evil, although, of course, child prostitution, Leviticus chapter 19, verse 29, and cult prostitution are declared evil. The Torah does deplore prostitution. The verse just cited, Leviticus chapter 19, verse 29, reads in full, "Do not profane your daughter to cause her to be a whore, lest the land fall to whoredom and the land become full of wickedness." Nevertheless, the post-biblical assessment by various religious groups and cultures of prostitution as among the greatest of sins and of prostitutes as among the lowest of people is more a cultural construct than a Bible-based value. The problem with marrying Canaanite women. Verse 16. And when you take wives from among their daughters for your sons, their daughters will lust after their gods and will cause your sons to lust after their gods. The Israelites are warned, if their sons marry Canaanite women, their sons will end up following the Canaanite religion. To say women have an immense impact on their husbands is an understatement. And God knew the Israelites were not yet strong in their monotheistic faith. See comment on following verse. Israelite men could easily be led astray by Canaanite wives. This diversion of Israelite men away from ethical monotheism need not even involve marriage. Just consorting sexually with Canaanite women could easily have led Israelite men to abandon, even if only temporarily, worship of God. See Numbers chapter 25, verses 1 through 3, which tells us as much about the power of the male sexual drive as it does about the tenuous hold of the Israelite religion over the Jews at that time. Verse 17, "You shall not make molten gods for yourselves." This is, of course, an allusion to the golden calf. Why we need religious rituals. Verse 18, "You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, eating unleavened bread for 7 days as I have commanded you." The rest of this chapter deals with the rituals the Israelites must observe once they enter the promised land. These rituals are intended as a way for the Israelites to keep faith in God alive once the land has been conquered and God is no longer intervening with miracles on their behalf. This is one of the major reasons for rituals, to keep faith alive once regular and apparent divine intervention ends. The following list of ritual commandments comes right after the prohibition against making molten gods. This suggests another important reason for religious rituals. One way people guard against the temptation to create idols and other false gods is by observing regular rituals that keep them focused on the one true God. One of the appeals of idols is they exist physically, whereas God does not. The practice of physical rituals helps keep people attuned to the reality of God's presence. Otherwise, God can become too abstract and difficult to connect to. Humans, being physical beings, need some physical connection to God. This helps explain why Christianity has many fewer ritual laws than Judaism. For Christians, God has taken on a physical form that provides them with a physical connection to God. But for Jews, since God is always non-physical, the way to have a physical connection to God is through ritual. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, Passover, is mentioned first because, having just experienced the Exodus from Egypt, it is the ritual observance most immediately relevant to the Israelites. Also, eating unleavened bread is a symbolic rejection of Egypt and its values. Given that the Egyptians invented the process of leavening, bread was a symbol of Egypt, just as eating pasta would be banned if one wanted a society to reject Italy. The 7 days of Passover are an echo of the 7 days of creation, as is always the case with the number 7 in the Torah. The Exodus signifies a new creation, God's chosen people, and ethical monotheism. For reasons having to do with calculating the new moon, and thereby the date of the holidays, in ancient Israel, and transmitting that information to other Jewish communities, Jews outside of Israel long ago developed the tradition of observing Passover for 8 days, and adding a day onto other biblical holidays as well. This led many Jews to overlook the direct connection between Passover and creation. Verse 18, continued, "At the set time of the month of Abib, for in the month of Abib you went forth from Egypt." The Hebrew word Abib means spring, which is when the holiday of Passover falls each year. The Israelites are commanded to observe this holiday during the spring in order to re-experience the Exodus from Egypt. Verse 19, "Every first issue of the womb is mine, from all your livestock that drop a male as firstling, whether cattle or sheep." Verse 20, "But the firstling of an ass you shall redeem with a sheep. If you do not redeem it, you must break its neck." See the explanation for this law in Exodus chapter 13, verse 13. Verse 20 continued, "And you must redeem every firstborn from among your sons. None shall appear before me empty-handed." Jews today still perform the ritual of the redemption of the firstborn son, which is known as Pidyon Haben. See the commentary to Numbers chapter 18, verses 15 through 16. The Sabbath demands sacrifices. Verse 21. 6 days you shall work, but on the seventh day you shall cease from labor. You shall cease from labor even at plowing time and harvest time. Living according to God's will generally and the Ten Commandments specifically demands making sacrifices. Everything good, every achievement, demands sacrifices. In the case of the Shabbat, that sacrifice is abstaining from work one day each week when doing so may diminish one's income or even employability. For example, in the Jews' early years in America, there were factory owners who would tell Jewish employees on Friday, "If you don't come in on Saturday, don't come in on Monday." However, as those who observe the Sabbath are well aware, the rewards usually far exceed the sacrifices. No practice in the Torah brings as much joy and elevates a life as does observance of the Shabbat. Leaving the world and its material concerns one day every week is literally and figuratively life-saving. Having prolonged meals with family and/or friends every week is uniquely bonding. And the Shabbat creates a communal life. No wonder it is the one ritual commanded in the Ten Commandments. Verse 22, "You shall observe the Feast of Weeks of the first fruits of the wheat harvest." The Feast of Weeks, in Hebrew Shavuot, weeks, is so named because it is observed exactly 7 weeks after Passover. It is also known as Pentecost. Verse 22 continued, "And the Feast of Ingathering at the turn of the year." The Feast of Ingathering is Sukkot, also known as Tabernacles. Since the Israelites will soon be living in an agricultural society, the festivals are connected to the agricultural cycle. But for millennia, Jewish tradition has identified the Feast of Weeks with the giving of the law at Sinai, and the Feast of Ingathering with Sukkot, during which Jews are commanded to eat and dwell in temporary booths, tabernacles, to commemorate the booths in which Jews dwelt during their 40 years in the desert. Verse 23. "Three times a year, all your males shall appear before the sovereign Lord, the God of Israel." Except for those few men who lived within easy walking distance of the temple, all the men had to leave their homes 3 times a year to gather with other men to worship God. Compared to what often draws men together, drinking, gambling, and carousing, this was a rather wholesome activity. There was, however, no prohibition on women, and children for that matter, joining their husbands on the holiday, and many did. But the commandment was only directed to men. Verse 24, "I will drive out nations from your path and enlarge your territory. No one will covet your land when you go up to appear before the Lord your God 3 times a year. Lest the men worry about leaving their homes vulnerable to theft and seizure in their absence, God promises to protect their land while they are away. Otherwise, men would fear leaving their families, livestock, and land. Verse 25, "You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened, and the sacrifice of the feast of Passover shall not be left lying until morning." Verse 26, "The choice first fruits of your soil you shall bring to the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk." According to the Torah, one is not permitted to boil a kid in the same substance, milk, with which the animal's mother gave it life. This law exists not for the sake of the animal, which is already dead, but to elevate the Israelites. There is something perverse, even mocking and cruel, in cooking a baby animal in its mother's milk. This injunction was considered so important that the Torah states it 3 times. In this verse, Exodus chapter 23, verse 19, and Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 21. See the commentary to Exodus chapter 23, verse 19. The Torah is rooted in distinctions: God-man, male-female, human-animal, and life-death. This law likely concerns the last. God does not want us to symbolically combine death, the dead animal, with life, milk, especially that of its mother, which sustained it. Judaism expanded this law into a general ban on consuming milk and meat at the same time. Verse 27. "And the Lord said to Moses, write down these commandments, for in accordance with these commandments I make a covenant with you and with Israel." Verse 28. "And he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He ate no bread and drank no water. And he wrote down on the tablets the terms of the covenant, the 10 commandments. As with the first set of tablets, Moses spent 40 days on Mount Sinai. This time, however, the people knew better than to try to replace him or God with an idol. Under ordinary circumstances, of course, a human being cannot go for 40 days without eating, let alone without drinking. The number 40, which recurs throughout the Torah, is a term most likely reflecting something highly significant, usually divinely significant, is taking place. The flood lasts for 40 days. The Israelites are in the desert for 40 years. And Moses is on Sinai for 40 days. All of them are divine miracles and world-altering. Verse 29. So Moses came down from Mount Sinai. And as Moses came down from the mountain bearing the two tablets of the pact, Moses was not aware that the skin of his face was radiant. Umberto Casuto points out the many repetitions in the concluding verses of this chapter. The radiant face of Moses is referred to three times. The veil Moses places on his face three times, and seven references to speaking in verses 29 to 35. That the Torah mentions a name three or seven times in a given section cannot be coincidental. Seven, as we have repeatedly seen, almost always harkens back to creation. But whatever the significance of the number, each serves as a type of embedded code denoting the section is a unified story with a single author. The Hebrew word for ray or radiant, keren, is spelled with the same Hebrew letters as the word for horn, keren. As a result, this verse has been misinterpreted to mean Moses came down from Mount Sinai with horns on his face, resulting, for instance, in the famous Michelangelo statue of Moses with horns. Sarna notes the use of the word keren, radiant, so similar to the word keren, horn, is probably a pointed allusion to the golden calf, and subtly emphasizes that the true mediator between God and Israel was not the fabricated, lifeless image of the horned animal, as the people thought, Exodus chapter 32, verses 1 through 4, but the living Moses. Verse 29 continued, since he had spoken with him. Verse 30. Aaron and all the Israelites saw that the skin of Moses' face was radiant, and they shrank from coming near him. Verse 31. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the chieftains in the assembly returned to him, and Moses spoke to them. The Torah does not specify what Moses said to Aaron and the leaders, but it is reasonable to assume he tried to calm and reassure them. Verse 32. Afterward, all the Israelites came near, and he instructed them concerning all that the Lord had imparted to him on Mount Sinai. Verse 33. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. Verse 34. Whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would leave the veil off until he came out. And when he came out and told the Israelites what he had been commanded, verse 35, the Israelites would see how radiant the skin of Moses' face was. Moses would then put the veil back over his face until he went in to speak with him. Presumably, Moses does not want the rays of light radiating from his face to intimidate the people. Chapter 35, verse 1. Moses then convoked the whole Israelite community and said to them, "These are the things that the Lord has commanded you to do." Verse 2. On 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day you shall have a Sabbath of complete rest, holy to the Lord. The remainder of Exodus is concerned with the building of the tabernacle. First, however, the laws of the Sabbath are reiterated to provide the Israelites with an important stipulation. Even though the building of the sanctuary is the holiest work they will engage in, they are not allowed to do it on the Sabbath. In the Torah and later Judaism, time is holier than place, and thus the observance of the holiest day of the week takes precedence over the building of the holiest place. Mishnah Shabbat 7:2 lists 39 types of labor done at the tabernacle, all of which are forbidden on the Sabbath. Abraham Joshua Heschel notes that in the Hebrew Bible, not even the Promised Land is called holy. While the holiness of the land and the holiness of the festivals depends on the actions of the Jewish people, the holiness of the Shabbat preceded Israel's existence. Genesis chapter 2, verse 3. Even if people fail to observe the Shabbat, it remains holy. Verse 2, continued. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. The Torah prescribes such a severe punishment for violating the Sabbath to emphasize the severity of the infraction. The Sabbath affirms God created the world, the foundational belief of ethical monotheism, of the new Israelite nation, and the new and better world that should emanate from them. Without the Sabbath, there will ultimately be no Jewish religion and no Jewish people. Hence the aphorism of the Jewish philosopher Ahad Ha'am, "More than Israel has kept the Sabbath has kept the Jews." Such an observation has not been made about any other ritual law in the Torah, including Kashrut and Yom Kippur. In the Ten Commandments, Commandment 2 and Commandments 4 through 9 carry the death penalty. No Jewish ritual other than the Sabbath is in the Ten Commandments, in part because there is no other Jewish ritual for which violators are given the death penalty. Though it is important to add, we have only one instance of this ever being carried out. See the next paragraph. Such is the unique importance of the Shabbat. Nevertheless, as noted elsewhere, in every case but murder, the overwhelming preponderance of evidence suggests the death penalty was on the books to teach the severity of the offense, rather than as an actual punishment to be enacted. With but one exception, we know of no case of an Israelite executed for working on the Sabbath. That exception takes place later, Numbers chapter 15, verses 32 through 36, when an Israelite gathers wood in public on the Sabbath. What is noteworthy about that case is that despite this verse, "Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death," the Israelites did not know what to do with the Sabbath violator in Numbers. God had to tell Moses to put the man to death. At the very least, that bears testimony to how rare it was, even 3,000 years ago, to put a person to death for violating the Sabbath. Essay: Why No Fire on the Sabbath? Verse 3. You shall kindle no fire throughout your settlements on the Sabbath day. There is very little specific legislation in the Torah concerning the Sabbath. The most significant prohibitions, alongside this one, are the ban against plowing and harvesting, Exodus chapter 34, verse 21, and an unclearly defined prohibition against leaving one's place on the Sabbath, which later Jewish law understood as a prohibition against going outside one's city limits, Exodus chapter 16, verse 29. Today, when a small percentage of the population engages in agricultural work, the prohibition against kindling a fire remains the most relevant Sabbath prohibition in the Torah. The question then is, why? Why is making a fire singled out as forbidden? The key to understanding why is this. Whereas the actions the Torah prohibits on Shabbat are also prohibited on the festivals, Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot, the one exception is making a fire. The Torah prohibits making a fire only on Shabbat. The Jewish Talmud, citing this verse, states, "On the Sabbath day you may not light, but you may light on a festival." Observant Jews, however, do not light a fire on a festival, though they permit transferring flame from a pre-existing fire, something forbidden on the Sabbath. And why does the Torah ban making a fire on Shabbat, but on no other holy days, except Yom Kippur, which is considered the Sabbath of Sabbaths, and has all the laws pertaining to the Sabbath? The answer must lie in the meaning of the Sabbath, to affirm that God is the Creator, by not working or creating on the day God ceased working and creating. Aside from making new life, conceiving a child, which I will address, making a fire is the ultimate symbolic act of human creation. Animals, too, make new life, but they do not make fire. As only God creates ex nihilo, out of nothing, the kindling of fire is the closest humans come to creating. By kindling fire, humans are engaging in an act uniquely close to creating, whereas the purpose of the Sabbath is to refrain from such acts in order to affirm the one Creator is God. Not only does fire seem to come from nothing, it also has the unique power to transform everything it touches. Everett Fox alludes to this. Since the Shabbat was apparently to be static in nature, or at least transformative of time alone, fire, which by its nature causes chemical changes, could not be employed. The Sabbath is a time to enjoy the world as it is. The uniquely transformative entity, fire, thus becomes the archetypal Sabbath prohibition. So then, why doesn't the Torah prohibit making a child, the only other act that creates something from nothing? For four possible reasons. First, as noted, animals also make new life. Therefore, making a new life is not uniquely human. Second, unlike fire, a new human life does not physically transform everything it touches. Third, as noted, Jewish law understands the Sabbath prohibition on work as applying to the 39 types of work carried out in the building of the tabernacle. Sexual relations were, of course, not one of those 39 types of work. Fourth, and most important, the Torah affirms life. Therefore, just as every Torah prohibition may, indeed must, be violated to save a human life, the prohibition on creating on Shabbat is suspended in order to make a new human life. The Torah adds the qualification throughout your settlements because the kindling of fire was allowed in the tabernacle and later in the temple for the special Sabbath sacrifices. See Talmud Shabbat 20a. The tabernacle and temple were not regarded as settlements. One might further ask, if fire is an act of creation, why did the Torah allow it in the temple? Because the purpose of the sacrificial fires in the temple was to affirm the Creator, whereas all other fires, fires throughout your settlements, had other purposes. Verse 4. Moses said further to the whole community of Israelites, "This is what the Lord has commanded." The Torah now returns to the subject of the tabernacle. The instructions for building the tabernacle were provided in chapters 25 through 31, where this structure was identified as the means through which God would dwell amidst the people. The narrative was then interrupted because the people built the golden calf, and God threatened he would no longer dwell in their midst. Since Moses has successfully petitioned God to forgive the people and dwell among them, the building of the tabernacle can resume. From this point until the end of the book of Exodus, the actual building of the tabernacle, as opposed to instructions for how it is to be built, is recorded. Regarding this repetition, some Bible scholars explain the Torah was written in accordance with different literary conventions than we are accustomed to today. For instance, Umberto Casuto argues ancient Near Eastern religious texts often dealt with the founding and building of a shrine, and most of these narratives would contain two parallel passages. The first passage would describe the plan of the shrine in minute detail, and the second would give an account of the construction using identical or similar phrasing. In this regard, this repetition is typical of literary texts of its time. Benno Jakob points out that whereas chapters 25 through 31 represent a continuous, uninterrupted address given by God to Moses, chapters 35 to 40 are filled with dramatic action. Therefore, the narratives supplement rather than solely replicate one another, though there is, as repeatedly noted in chapters 36 through 40, much replication. Verse 5. Take from among you gifts to the Lord. Everyone whose heart so moves him shall bring them. Gifts for the Lord, gold, silver, and copper. The laws of donating to the tabernacle are very different from the laws concerning donating to the poor. Given that God has no need of gifts, he wants gifts offered to him to be voluntary. In contrast, the poor do need donations, and therefore such help must be commanded, Deuteronomy chapter 26, verse 12, and not be dependent on voluntary contributions. Since the people were instructed to bring only as much as they felt moved to contribute, the following account of what they brought seems to reflect a deep desire to connect with God. The list of items in this chapter is therefore not merely a repetition of the list provided earlier by God, see chapter 25, verses 1 through 7, but also a testament to the depth of that desire. Verse 6. Blue, purple, and crimson yarns, fine linen, and goat's hair. Verse 7. Tanned ram skins, dolphin skins, and acacia wood. Verse 8. Oil for lighting, spices for the anointing oil and for the aromatic incense. Verse 9. Lapis lazuli and other stones for setting, for the ephod and the breastpiece. Verse 10. And let all among you who are skilled come and make all that the Lord has commanded. Verse 11. the tabernacle, its tent and its covering, its clasps and its planks, its bars, its posts, and its sockets. Verse 12, the ark and its poles, the cover and the curtain for the screen. Verse 13, the table and its poles and all its utensils, and the bread of display. Verse 14, the lampstand for lighting, its furnishings and its lamps, and the oil for lighting. Verse 15, the altar of incense and its poles, the anointing oil and the aromatic incense, and the entrance screen for the entrance of the tabernacle. Verse 16, the altar of burnt offering, its copper grating, its poles, and all its furnishings, the laver and its stand. Verse 17, the hangings of the enclosure, its posts and its sockets, and the screen for the gate of the court. Verse 18, the pegs for the tabernacle, the pegs for the enclosure, and their cords. Verse 19, the service vestments for officiating in the sanctuary, the sacral vestments of Aaron the priest, and the vestments of his sons for priestly service. Verse 20, so the whole community of the Israelites left Moses' presence. Verse 21, and everyone who excelled in ability and everyone whose spirit moved him came, bringing to the Lord his offering for the work of the tent of meeting and for all its service and for the sacral vestments. Verse 22, men and women, all whose hearts moved them, all who would make an elevation offering of gold to the Lord, came bringing brooches, earrings, rings, and pendants, gold objects of all kinds. The Torah repeatedly states both men and women were involved in the building of the tabernacle. In addition to bringing jewelry, yarn, and other gifts, women also took responsibility for spinning the goat's hair used to make one of the protective coverings for the tabernacle. Verse 23, and everyone who had in his possession blue, purple, and crimson yarns, fine linen, goat's hair, tanned ram skins, and dolphin skins brought them. Verse 24, everyone who would make gifts of silver or copper brought them as gifts for the Lord. And everyone who had in his possession acacia wood for any work of the service brought that. Verse 25, and all the skilled women spun with their own hands and brought what they had spun in blue, purple, and crimson yarns and in fine linen. Verse 26, and all the women who excelled in that skill spun the goat's hair. Verse 27, and the chieftains brought lapis lazuli and other stones for setting, for the ephod and for the breastpiece. Verse 28, and spices and oil for lighting, for the anointing oil, and for the aromatic incense. Verse 29, thus the Israelites, all the men and women whose hearts moved them to bring anything for the work that the Lord through Moses had commanded to be done, brought it as a freewill offering to the Lord. Verse 30, and Moses said to the Israelites, see, the Lord has singled out by name Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. Verse 31, he has endowed him with a divine spirit of skill, ability, and knowledge in every kind of craft. Verse 32, and has inspired him to make designs for work in gold, silver, and copper. Verse 33, to cut stones for setting and to carve wood, to work in every kind of designer's craft. Verse 34, and to give directions. He and Aholiab, son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan. Verse 35, have been endowed with the skill to do any work of the carver, the designer, the embroiderer in blue, purple, crimson yarns, and in fine linen, and of the weaver, as worker in all crafts and as makers of designs. Chapter 36. Chapters 36 through 40 largely recapitulate chapters 25 through 28 and 30. Those earlier chapters record God's instructions to Moses on how to build the tabernacle, the Mishkan, while these chapters record its actual building. Because much of this material is repetition, the commentary here is briefer and restricted to new material. In each instance, I briefly note where the earlier original recording of this material can be found. Verse 1. Then let Bezalel and Aholiab and all the skilled persons, whom the Lord has endowed with skill and ability to perform expertly all the tasks connected with the service of the sanctuary, carry out all that the Lord has commanded. This verse could easily have read, let then all the skilled persons perform expertly. Why are the words, whom the Lord has endowed with skills and ability, added, The likely reason is the Torah wishes to emphasize that people who have special skills and abilities do not have themselves to thank or praise for those abilities. They have them because God gave them these abilities. Even those who do not believe God is the source of their abilities should not attribute their innate talents to anything they have done. If they don't want to credit God, they should at least credit their good luck. Otherwise, they become like the man of whom it is said, "He is a self-made man, and he worships his Creator." There is nothing intrinsically wrong with recognizing a special ability one has. In fact, it is an exercise in false modesty not to. A great singer who denies that he or she has a great voice is engaging in false modesty, not humility. The humble person recognizes his or her specialness and thanks God or simple good fortune for it. And if that person is religious, he or she asks how God would want that talent to be used. People with exceptional talents or abilities are therefore not to be praised for those abilities or talents, but for what they do with them. Verse 2. Moses then called Bezalel and Aholiab and every skilled person whom the Lord had endowed with skill, everyone who excelled in ability, to undertake the task and carry it out. Verse 3. They took over from Moses all the gifts that the Israelites had brought to carry out the tasks connected with the service of the sanctuary. The donations of the people are represented as lying in a heap before Moses, and the artisans took what they required. Hertz. Verse 3 continued, but when these continued to bring freewill offerings to him morning after morning, verse 4, all the artisans who were engaged in the tasks of the sanctuary came, each from the task upon which he was engaged, verse 5, and said to Moses, "The people are bringing more than is needed for the tasks entailed in the work that the Lord has commanded to be done." Verse 6, Moses thereupon had this proclamation made throughout the camp, "Let no man or woman make further effort toward gifts for the sanctuary." This may be the only time in recorded history a leader told his people, "The government has enough money. Don't give us any more." Verse 6 continued, so the people stopped bringing. Verse 7, their efforts had been more than enough for all the tasks to be done. Since the Torah routinely depicts the Israelites in a negative light, when it shows them in a positive light, as it does here for their generosity, it has credibility. Like most of us, the Israelites had their good traits and their bad traits. This is worth remembering when we assess individuals or groups. At the same time, it is also important not to fall into the trap of excusing truly evil people or groups by saying, "Everyone has their faults," or "We're all a mixed bag," or "I try to find the good in everyone." There are individuals and groups whose evil so outweighs whatever good they have done, it is wrong to lump them with the rest of humanity, which is largely made up of people and groups who do both good and bad, but not true evil. And there are people whose good so outweighs whatever sins they have committed, they too should not be lumped in with the rest of humanity. Verse 8. Then all the skilled among those engaged in the work made the tabernacle of 10 strips of cloth, which they made of fine twisted linen, blue, purple, and crimson yarns. Into these they worked a design of cherubim. These verses concerning the curtains of the tabernacle, verses 8 through 19, correspond to Exodus chapter 26, verses 1 through 11 and 14. Thus, for example, chapter 36, verse 9, is a precise restatement of chapter 26, verse 2. Verse 9. The length of each cloth was 28 cubits. And the width of each cloth was 4 cubits, all cloths having the same measurements. Verse 10, they joined 5 of the cloths to one another, and they joined the other 5 cloths to one another. Verse 11, they made loops of blue wool on the edge of the outermost cloth of the one set, and did the same on the edge of the outermost cloth of the other set. Verse 12, they made 50 loops on the one cloth, and they made 50 loops on the edge of the end cloth of the other set, the loops being opposite one another. Verse 13, and they made 50 gold clasps and coupled the units to one another with the clasps, so that the tabernacle became one whole. Verse 14, they made cloths of goat's hair for a tent over the tabernacle. They made the cloths 11 in number. Verse 15, The length of each cloth was 30 cubits, and the width of each cloth was 4 cubits, the 11 cloths having the same measurements. Verse 16, they joined 5 of the cloths by themselves and the other 6 cloths by themselves. Verse 17, they made 50 loops on the edge of the outermost cloth of the one set, and they made 50 loops on the edge of the end cloth of the other set. Verse 18, they made 50 copper clasps to couple the tent together so that it might become one whole. Verse 19, and they made a covering of tanned ram skins for the tent and a covering of dolphin skins above. Verse 20, they made the planks for the tabernacle of acacia wood upright. The description of the wooden planks in the tabernacle, which runs from chapter 36, verses 20 through 34, corresponds to the earlier description in Exodus chapter 26, verses 15 through 29. The Midrash has an interesting environmentalist take on the injunction to build the tabernacle with wood from the acacia, a non-fruit-bearing tree. God set an example for all time, that when a man is about to build his house from a fruit-bearing tree, he should be reminded, if when the Supreme King of Kings commanded the temple to be erected, his instructions were to use only such trees as are non-fruit-bearing, even though all things belong to him, how much more should this be in our case? See commentary on Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 19, the prohibition against destroying fruit-bearing trees. Verse 21. The length of each plank was 10 cubits, the width of each plank 1.5 cubits. Verse 22. Each plank had 2 tenons parallel to each other. They did the same with all the planks of the tabernacle. Verse 23. Of the planks of the tabernacle, they made 20 planks for the south side. Verse 24. Making 40 silver sockets under the 20 planks, 2 sockets under one plank for its 2 tenons, and 2 sockets under each following plank for its 2 tenons. Verse 25, and for the other side wall of the tabernacle, the north side, 20 planks. Verse 26, with their 40 silver sockets, 2 sockets under one plank, and 2 sockets under each following plank. Verse 27, and for the rear of the tabernacle, to the west, they made 6 planks. Verse 28, and they made 2 planks for the corners of the tabernacle at the rear. Verse 29. They matched at the bottom, but terminated as one at the top into one ring. They did so with both of them at the 2 corners. Verse 30. Thus there were 8 planks with their sockets of silver, 16 sockets, 2 under each plank. Verse 31. They made bars of acacia wood, 5 for the planks of the one side wall of the tabernacle. Verse 32, 5 bars for the planks of the other side wall of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the planks of the wall of the tabernacle at the rear, to the west. Verse 33, they made the center bar to run halfway up the planks from end to end. Verse 34, they overlaid the planks with gold, and made their rings of gold as holders for the bars, and they overlaid the bars with gold. Verse 35, they made the curtain of blue, purple, and crimson yarns and fine twisted linen, working it into a design of cherubim. The description of the curtain to section off the Holy of Holies, the area that will enshrine the ark, and the screen for the door of the tent in verses 35 through 38 corresponds to Exodus chapter 26, verses 31 through 37. Verse 36. They made for it 4 posts of acacia wood and overlaid them with gold, with their hooks of gold, and they cast for them 4 silver sockets. Verse 37, they made the screen for the entrance of the tent of blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and fine twisted linen done in embroidery. Verse 38, and 5 posts for it with their hooks. They overlaid their tops and their bands with gold, but the 5 sockets were of copper. Chapter 37, verse 1. Bezalel made the ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. As noted in the introduction to chapter 36, much of the material covered in the last chapters of Exodus repeat details about the building of the tabernacle recorded earlier. This applies to chapter 37 in its entirety, parts of which are found in chapters 25 and 30. The opening verses, 1 through 9, which detail the building of the ark, parallel chapter 25, verses 10 through 15, and chapters 18 through 20. Any commentary on this material is found there. Verse 2. He overlaid it with pure gold inside and out, and he made a gold molding for it round about. Verse 3. He cast 4 gold rings for it, for its 4 feet, 2 rings on one of its side walls and 2 rings on the other. Verse 4, he made poles of acacia wood, overlaid them with gold. Verse 5, and inserted the poles into the rings on the side walls of the ark for carrying the ark. Verse 6, he made a cover of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. Verse 7, he made 2 cherubim of gold. He made them of hammered work at the 2 ends of the cover. Verse 8, 1 cherub at one end and the other cherub at the other end. He made the cherubim of one piece with the cover at its 2 ends. Verse 9, the cherubim had their wings spread out above, shielding the cover with their wings. They faced each other. The faces of the cherubim were turned toward the cover. Verse 10, he made the table of acacia wood, 2 cubits long, 1 cubit wide, and 1.5 cubits high. The construction of the table in the tabernacle, verses 10 through 16, corresponds to Exodus chapter 25, verses 23 through 29. Verse 11. He overlaid it with pure gold and made a gold molding around it. Verse 12. He made a rim of a hand's breadth around it and made a gold molding for its rim round about. Verse 13. He cast 4 gold rings for it and attached the rings to the 4 corners at its 4 legs. Verse 14, the rings were next to the rim as holders for the poles to carry the table. Verse 15, he made the poles of acacia wood for carrying the table and overlaid them with gold. Verse 16, the utensils that were to be upon the table, its bowls, ladles, jugs, and jars with which to offer libations, he made of pure gold. Verse 17, he made the lampstand of pure gold. He made the lampstand, its base and its shaft, of hammered work. Its cups, calyxes, and petals were of one piece with it. Verses 17 through 24 describe the making of the lampstand, in Hebrew the menorah, whose construction was commanded in Exodus chapter 25, verses 31 through 40. Verse 18. 6 branches issued from its sides, 3 branches from one side of the lampstand, and 3 branches from the other side of the lampstand. Verse 19. There were 3 cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with calyx and petals on one branch. And there were 3 cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with calyx and petals on the next branch. So for all 6 branches issuing from the lampstand. Verse 20. On the lampstand itself, there were 4 cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with calyx and petals. Verse 21, a calyx of one piece with it under a pair of branches, and a calyx of one piece with it under the second pair of branches, and a calyx of one piece with it under the last pair of branches. So for all 6 branches issuing from it. Verse 22, their calyxes and their stems were of one piece with it, the whole of it a single hammered piece of pure gold. Verse 23, he made its 7 lamps, its tongs, and its fire pans of pure gold. Verse 24, he made it and all its furnishings out of a talent of pure gold. Verse 25, he made the incense altar of acacia wood, 1 cubit long and 1 cubit wide, square, and 2 cubits high. Its horns were of one piece with it. Verses 25 through 27, describing the altar of incense, correspond to Exodus chapter 30, verses 1 through 9. Verse 26. He overlaid it with pure gold, its top, its sides round about, and its horns, and he made a gold molding for it round about. Verse 27. He made 2 gold rings for it under its molding, on its 2 walls, on opposite sides, as holders for the poles with which to carry it. Verse 28. He made the poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with gold. Verse 29, he prepared the sacred anointing oil and the pure aromatic incense, expertly blended. The final verse of this chapter is a one-verse summary of Exodus chapter 30, verses 22 through 33 and 34 through 37. Chapter 38. Verse 1. He made the altar for burnt offering of acacia wood, 5 cubits long and 5 cubits wide, square, and 3 cubits high. Verses 1 through 7, dealing with the altar for burnt offerings, correspond to Exodus chapter 27, verses 1 through 8, and chapter 30, verses 18 through 21. Verse 2. He made horns for it on its 4 corners, the horns being of 1 piece with it, and he overlaid it with copper. Verse 3, he made all the utensils of the altar, the pails, the scrapers, the basins, the flush hooks, and the fire pans. He made all these utensils of copper. Verse 4, he made for the altar a grating of meshwork in copper, extending below, under its ledge, to its middle. Verse 5, he cast 4 rings at the 4 corners of the copper grating as holders for the poles. Verse 6, he made the poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with copper. Verse 7, and he inserted the poles into the rings on the side walls of the altar to carry it by them. He made it hollow of boards. Verse 8, he made the laver of copper and its stand of copper from the mirrors of the women who performed tasks at the entrance of the tent of meeting. This is a reference to the tent mentioned in Exodus chapter 33, Moses pitched outside the camp, and where he would go to commune face to face with God. Exodus chapter 33, verses 7 through 11. Later, after the tabernacle was completed, the tent of meeting became the inner area where the ark resided and which became the Holy of Holies. There is no other reference in the Torah to the women who worked at the entrance to the tent, nor is it clear what they did. But reference to women doing this type of work hundreds of years later is found in 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 22, in a passage about 2 corrupt priests who took advantage of these women. Verse 9. He made the enclosure. On the south side, 100 cubits of hangings of fine twisted linen for the enclosure. Verses 9 through 20 describe the building of the outer courtyard of the tabernacle, and correspond to Exodus chapter 27, verses 9 through 19. Verse 10. With their 20 posts and their 20 sockets of copper, the hooks and bands of the posts being silver. Verse 11. On the north side, 100 cubits, with their 20 posts and their 20 sockets of copper, the hooks and bands of the posts being silver. Verse 12. On the west side, 50 cubits of hangings, with their 10 posts and their 10 sockets, the hooks and bands of the posts being silver. Verse 13, and on the front side to the east, 50 cubits. Verse 14, 15 cubits of hangings on the one flank, with their 3 posts and their 3 sockets. Verse 15, and 15 cubits of hangings on the other flank, on each side of the gate of the enclosure, with their 3 posts and their 3 sockets. Verse 16, all the hangings around the enclosure were of fine twisted linen. Verse 17, the sockets for the posts were of copper. The hooks and bands of the posts were of silver. The overlay of their tops was of silver. All the posts of the enclosure were banded with silver. Verse 18. The screen of the gate of the enclosure, done in embroidery, was of blue, purple, and crimson yarns and fine twisted linen. It was 20 cubits long. Its height or width was 5 cubits, like that of the hangings of the enclosure. Verse 19. The posts were 4. Their 4 sockets were of copper, their hooks of silver, and the overlay of their tops was of silver, as were also their bands. Verse 20. All the pegs of the tabernacle and of the enclosure round about were of copper. Verse 21. These are the records of the tabernacle of the pact, which were drawn up at Moses' bidding, the work of the Levites under the direction of Ithamar, son of Aaron the priest. Verse 22. Now Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, had made all that the Lord had commanded Moses. Verse 23. At his side was Aholiab, son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan, carver and designer and embroiderer in blue, purple, and crimson yarns and in fine linen. The Torah regularly credits those who do good. For example, in Exodus, we learn the names of the 2 midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, who courageously resisted Pharaoh's order to kill the newborn male Israelites. Here, the Torah credits by name several times Bezalel and Aholiab. And we are told specifically what Aholiab did. He was a carver and designer and embroiderer in blue, purple, and crimson yarns and in fine linen. There is a lesson to be drawn. When giving a compliment or when criticizing, the more specific we are, the more meaningful the compliment or critique will be, and the more likely the person receiving the compliment or criticism will take it to heart. Verse 24. All the gold that was used for the work and all the work of the sanctuary, the elevation offering of gold, came to 29 talents and 730 shekels by the sanctuary weight. Verses 24 through 29 detail the exact quantities of precious metals used in constructing the tabernacle. I have previously cited Rabbi Saul Berman's fine conjecture that by detailing these quantities, the Torah intended to foreclose the possibility of corrupt priests insisting on the need for more gold and silver than necessary, which they could then pocket. Verse 25. The silver of those of the community who were recorded came to 100 talents and 1,775 shekels by the sanctuary weight. Verse 26. A half shekel a head, half a shekel by the sanctuary weight, for each one who was entered in the records from the age of 20 years up, 603,550 men. Once again, the Torah repeats the details concerning the half shekel and the number of men of fighting age. See as well Numbers chapter 1, verse 46. What is remarkable here is the specific number of men given, not rounded off to the nearest 100,000, but precise to the nearest 10. It doesn't appear to be a made-up number, but actual documentation. Verse 27. The 100 talents of silver were for casting the sockets of the sanctuary and the sockets for the curtain. 100 sockets to the 100 talents, a talent a socket. Verse 28. And of the 1,775 shekels, he made hooks for the posts, overlay for their tops, and bands around them. Verse 29. The copper from the elevation offering came to 70 talents and 2,400 shekels. Verse 30. Of it he made the sockets for the entrance of the tent of meeting, the copper altar and its copper grating, and all the utensils of the altar. Verse 31. The sockets of the enclosure round about, and the sockets of the gate of the enclosure, and all the pegs of the tabernacle, and all the pegs of the enclosure round about. Chapter 39. Verse 1. Of the blue, purple, and crimson yarns, they also made the service vestments for officiating in the sanctuary. They made Aaron's sacral vestments, as the Lord had commanded Moses. Nearly all of this chapter, verses 1 through 31, is devoted to the priest's garments. Once again, this is material covered earlier in Exodus. Verse 2. The ephod was made of gold, blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and fine twisted linen. The description of the priest's ephod, breastplate, in verses 2 through 7, corresponds to the previous description in Exodus chapter 28, verses 6 through 12. The difference being that in the earlier chapter it was described in the future tense, and they shall make the ephod, while here it is described after the fact, and he made the ephod. Verse 3. They hammered out sheets of gold and cut threads to be worked into designs among the blue, the purple, and the crimson yarns, and the fine linen. The earlier passage, Exodus chapter 28, verses 6 through 12, does not mention the hammering out of sheets of gold. The verse here describes how the gold was worked into the garments. Verse 4. They made for it attaching shoulder pieces. They were attached at its two ends. Verse 5. The decorated band that was upon it was made like it, of one piece with it, of gold, blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and fine twisted linen, as the Lord had commanded Moses. Verse 6. They bordered the lazuli stones with frames of gold, engraved with seal engravings of the names of the sons of Israel. Verse 7. They were set on the shoulder pieces of the ephod as stones of remembrance for the Israelites, as the Lord had commanded Moses. Verse 8. The breast piece was made in the style of the ephod, of gold, blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and fine twisted linen. The making of the breastplate described here in verses 8 to 21 corresponds to the equally detailed earlier description ordaining how the breastplate is to be made. Exodus chapter 28, verses 15 through 28. Verse 9. It was square. They made the breastpiece doubled, a span in length and a span in width doubled. Verse 10, they set in it four rows of stones. The first row was a row of carnelian, chrysolite, and emerald. Verse 11, the second row, a turquoise, a sapphire, and an amethyst. Verse 12, the third row, a jacinth,